Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Lisa Mullins. Brian Coleman is a hip-hop junkie, and his favorite group of all, Public Enemy.
Burn, Hollywood, burn. I smell a riot going on. First the guilty, now they're gone. Yeah, I'll check out a movie, but it'll take a black one to move me.
This is Public Enemy's song, Burn, Hollywood, Burn, from their 1990 album, Fear of a Black Planet. And even fans of the song might wonder why the artist Ice Cube makes a guest rapping cameo.
Ice Cube is down with the P.E. Now every single kid wanna see me. Big Daddy, a smooth word to mother. Let's check out a flick that exploits the color.
Now, it may sound like a bit of minutia, but music fanatics crave it. And it's the kind of information you learn from an album's liner notes, those little inserts that include everything from song lyrics to behind-the-scenes info to acknowledgments. The thing is, traditionally, not many hip-hop albums include liner notes, and that's where Brian Coleman comes in. Coleman is a music journalist and a historian. He's based in Malden, Massachusetts. He spent nearly a decade creating what he calls invisible liner notes. He interviews the artists, the DJs, and producers behind classic hip-hop albums and turns those interviews into the liner notes that never were. In 2007, he published them in a book called Check the Technique, Liner Notes for Hip-Hop Junkies. And now Coleman's out with Check the Technique, Volume 2, More Liner Notes for Hip-Hop Junkies. It includes more than 80 interviews and discusses 25 of the greatest hip-hop albums of the 1980s and 90s. We spoke to him recently about the book and began by asking him when his passion for hip-hop began.
I heard this song called My Uzi Weighs a Ton, which was off of the first Public Enemy record.
Yeah, step back, get away, give the brothers a room. You got the whole turn me up when the beat goes boom. Lyric to lyric, line to line, and then you all understand my reputation for rhyme.
I was listening to a lot of punk at the time, and I was part of the punk scene, and it just hit me. It had the same kind of energy as punk did. It had the same attitude as punk did. Kind of from that point on, it was a love affair that has brought me up to the present day.
In that love affair, though, there was something missing, and that's the liner notes. And maybe you can tell us, remind us, for those who don't know, what liner notes are and were, because they were more popular than they are right now, and why
sure.
You don't find them on hip-hop albums.
There's different kinds of liner notes. You can go to the extreme, which is kind of what I do, which are these lengthy, that would be something that would be included like in a box set or a greatest hits type of thing. But you can go down to the very basics, which is just listing the producer or the engineer and kind of leaving it at that. I think the reason is it's just fans, and it's not just specific to hip-hop, always want to know more. And I always wanted to know more. When I was listening to something, you kind of make up these mythologies in your own mind about what was happening when these albums were made, and what were they thinking when they did this, but you never actually knew for sure. The reason that hip-hop specifically never had it was there's an immediacy to hip-hop music and the art form and honestly the industry. And it's as soon as it gets done, the first thing you think about is not, oh, let's do liner notes and let's make a beautiful package. It's let's get it out to the radio, let's get it out on the streets, let's start selling it.
Because it's so topical?
Keep in mind, hip-hop was never an album-based format in its earliest years. It was always single-based because it's also youth music, and young people want to have what's the hippest, latest thing. So sitting on an album after you finish it for 6 months was just not a reality.
Okay, so if you're writing now in this Volume 2 of Check the Technique about songs that came out in the 80s and 90s, who did you get to talk now, and what took them so long?
Well, I think now it's people are starting to ask them more. Somebody at a recent book event I did asked me, like, how did you get all these secrets out of all these artists? And I said they weren't secrets, just nobody ever asked them these questions, and there's a difference.
Was it hard to get people to talk, though?
No.
I mean, talk about speaking with Ice Cube, who we mentioned earlier, who we heard from earlier.
Yeah.
You had an hour and a half long interview with him.
Yeah.
Was it hard to get, and was it hard to pull information from him?
Sometimes some of the artists can be hard to get. The interviews themselves are never difficult. Once you get them kind of on the hook, so to speak, it's easy to reel them in because they love talking about this. They're talking about usually their first or second album at a more innocent time in their career where the industry hadn't fully kind of taken hold of them. And they love talking about these early triumphs that they had.
It's funny. In a way, you're benefiting from them looking in hindsight. Because
they
have more perspective.
Totally. Well, you don't have the same perspective. If liner notes had been done originally, they would be different than they are now 15, 20 years later, because these people can look back through a lens of an entire career versus when they were 17, 18, 19 years old, and their whole worldview is completely different.
So tell us more about your talk with Ice Cube.
So Ice Cube, the thing that was cool about that was clearly Ice Cube has better things to do than to talk to me for an hour and a half. It doesn't benefit his career. He saw my last book, felt it was important enough, and spent the time. So I was honored by that. I pretty much wanted to know everything from Cube. That there's a lot of mystery around that album specifically, his first one, America's Most Wanted, because he had just left NWA. For example, like a song like Once Upon a Time in the Projects, which is a funny song and a great storytelling song, but how many of those stories were actually true?
I sat on the couch, but it wasn't safe. And then I put my knives on a coffee table. Her brother came in, he's in the gang banging, cause he walked up and said, "What's set you claim?"
Were they true?
This happens to me fairly often. They'll say, well, some of them were and some of them weren't, but they won't say exactly which ones. There's a balance between knowing every single thing and then having some things left to your imagination. And keep in mind, maybe he wants to save it for his own book. He doesn't want to give everything to me, which is fine with me, too. I have no problems with that.
Is it true that you used a cassette recorder, which I have great respect for, by the way, when you were interviewing these hip-hop artists, and that you actually hand-transcribed the notes?
That is true. And I tell people that, especially writers that are younger than I am, that I do that. And they're like, you're an idiot. Like, what is the matter with you?
I think it's great.
It's by far the least efficient way you could do it. But it also allows you to become that much closer with the material and kind of experience it on one extra level. I will continue to do it as long as they continue to make cassette tapes and as long as my equipment still works.
Let's hear another example of a song that you write about and a group you write about. This is a song by the group Stetsasonic. It's from their 1988 album, In Full Gear. The song is Talkin' All That Jazz.
Well, here's how it started. Heard you on the radio, talking about rap, saying all that crap about how we sample, give an example. Think we'll let you get away with that. You criticize our method of how we make records. You said it wasn't art, so now we're gonna rip you apart.
Stop. Check it out, my man. This is the music of a hip-hop band, jazz.
This was an important song. It was basically Stetsasonic sticking up for hip-hop. There was a jazz artist named James M. Toomey. He basically was on a radio interview saying, oh, with this hip-hop stuff, and they don't know what they're doing, and they're just pushing buttons. So this also kind of talks about where hip-hop was in 1987, 1988. People were still saying it was a fad. People were still saying these guys have no talent. They're just pushing buttons. This is not like being in a rock band or a jazz group or anything like that. So this was really Stetsasonic saying, we're going to stand up for hip hop and we're not going to let somebody who doesn't know what he's talking about talk about us and talk about our peers like that.
You see, you misunderstood. A sample just a tactic, a portion of my method, a tool.
In fact, it's
only of importance when I make it a priority.
And what we samples are by the majority.
But you and
now, the interesting irony is that James M. Toomey later on made a lot of money when Notorious B.I.G. sampled him on this song called Juicy that was an M. Toomey song. So now you talk to him and he's a big hip-hop fan. But that's why that song is great, because it's also, it's catchy, you can dance to it, it had a great video, but it was making a statement. And that's really when hip-hop achieves its highest state, is when it combines all of those things.
So this is the perspective that you want to get in the invisible liner notes.
Definitely.
The liner notes that are now in print.
There's a lot going on in that song, and that's exactly what these books are all about, is kind of getting to the bottom of the complexity of all this stuff.
Brian, the longest chapter in your book is devoted to somebody who I think is less well-known. He's a rapper called Edo G. Tell us who he is.
Edo G is from Roxbury. Around town, he's known well by anyone who knows anything about the local scene, especially the local hip-hop scene. Nationally, he's known a little bit, but people would think of him more as like they'd know one or two or three songs, but not really the full breadth of his catalog. So I talk about his first album, which is called Life of a Kid in the Ghetto.
Sometimes I feel like a nut, and sometimes I don't, yo. Sometimes I feel like a nut, and sometimes I don't, now.
So that was the song called Feel Like a Nut, which was one side of Edo G, which was very goofy, having fun, kind of chasing girls around. And interestingly, according to Ed and other people in his camp, that's the song that got him signed. But there are a lot of other songs on that album that are a lot deeper and talk about a lot of really important social and political things.
Hey, yo, be a father. If not, why bother, son? A boy can make them, but a man can raise one. If you did it, admit it, to stick with it. Don't say it ain't.
So there was really that range, and I asked Ed, you know, do you regret having so many different aspects to that album, like to showing all those different sides of yourself? Because sometimes that can get, you can kind of maybe spread yourself too thin. And he was like, no, that was me. That was what I was at that time. And I have no regrets about it at all.
You've called this album by Ed O.G., Life of a Kid in the Ghetto, the most important album in Boston hip-hop history.
Yeah.
What was so significant about it?
It was really the first major album by anyone in the city that was heard nationwide. People may or may not know that Guru, who is the rapper MC from the group Gangstar, was also from Boston. But he actually left Boston before Gangstar became an entity, became a big group and well-known. So I love Guru, I love Gangstar, but you can't really consider him a purely Boston guy because he left town, and Ed has always stayed in town and represented his town and his neighborhood, and he still lives pretty much right where he grew up.
In Roxbury.
In Roxbury, Dorchester line. So that's important. That's important for fans. There have been a lot of great records that have come out of Boston, but you have to kind of keep in mind, too, at the time that there had really never been a huge Boston record like that. Not in hip-hop, so Ed was the guy, the torchbearer for really what everything that was to come after that.
Be prepared, because love is going to get you. It'll always be your child, even if she ain't with you.
You know, when we were doing research for this interview, we noticed that there is one review of your book, Check the Technique, Volume 2, that said that you don't merely compile fresh liner notes and anecdotes. You capture hip-hop's spirit from the 80s and the mid-90s. This was from Entertainment Weekly. How do you characterize that hip-hop spirit during that time, and is it still there now?
The hip-hop spirit is definitely still there now. I mean, it's difficult to talk about hip-hop in a kind of a general way now because there's so many different kinds of hip-hop. I mean, does that mean Drake, or does that mean some unknown kind of independent artist that a lot of people haven't ever heard of? You have to be creative. You don't have a record label and industry that you can kind of lean on. You usually don't have much money, so it's kind of like, how do we make this happen with almost no money, and how do we scrape this together, and how do we be innovative even though we don't have all of the equipment that some of these big stars might have? There's a lot more pressure, but it can also create that much more energy because you're hungry and you're kind of trying to do something that no one's ever done before. And that's really what hip-hop's about. I think you never, ever wanted to copy what someone else had done. You would kind of build on what had come before you, but you had to kind of branch out and do something new, whether that was as a rapper, something that you were going to say lyrically, a different style you were going to invent, or as a producer, take a piece of equipment that existed and use it in a different way to sample things, to incorporate live playing, for instance, and things like that. So that's the spirit that's always drawn me to it, and that spirit still exists with a lot of artists today.
I'm wrestling with words and ideas. My ears prick, seeking what will transmit. Describes can apply to transcript.
Brian Coleman is a music journalist and historian. His new book is called Check the Technique, Volume 2, More Liner Notes for Hip-Hop Junkies. Brian's going to be doing an event at the Brattle Theater next month called Check the Technique, Hip-Hop on Film. There's more information on our website, radioboston.org. Thanks so much for coming in, Brian.
It was a true pleasure. I appreciate it.
Skyscrapers is colossus. The cost of living is preposterous. Stay alive, you pray or die, no options.
And we're going to go out now on another favorite song of Brian's. This is the song Respiration by Black Star. Tomorrow on Radio Boston, we turn the clock back to the Beatles and hear about a Cambridge woman's research into their lasting impact on fans. That's tomorrow on Radio Boston. Radio Boston is a production of WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. Our producers are Amory Sievertson, Alex Kingsbury, Emma Jean Weinstein, Kathleen McNerney, and Jamie Bologna. Tim Skog is our technical director and the man behind the music mixes. I'm Lisa Mullins. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.
Bless the holes in the night till she bless sunshine. Breathe in the hail vapors from bright stars that shine. Breathe out. We smoke, retrace the skyline. Heard the bass ride out like an ancient maiden call. I can't take it, y'all. I can feel the city breathing, chest heaving against the flesh of the evening. Sigh before it died like the last train leaving.
Breathing in deep city breaths. Tita Shona, it's steps. We stoop to new lows. Hell froze the night the city slept. The beast crept through concrete jungles.